Reality and mythology get mixed up a lot in the American West. The bold stories a lot of us learned as kids about the brave settlers who tamed a wilderness tarnish just a bit when exposed to light and air. Our guest this hour provides light and air and maps and graphs and more to explain just how unwilderness much of the western part of our country was in the 1800s when white people moved in to stay. Remember, it had been occupied by Native Americans for thousands of years before white colonization. Sarah Dant is the author of Losing Eden, an environmental history of the American West. Sarah Dant is history professor at Weber State University in Utah, specializing in environmental politics. She's written many articles on politics and the environment and is the co-author of a two-volume encyclopedia of national parks from about a decade ago. Sarah Dant, thanks for joining us on The Exchange.
Thank you so much. I'm looking forward to this.
So you write that Losing Eden is my Valentine to the American West. How did the project take shape?
Well, I've been a lifelong resident of the West. I've always loved living here. I've lived almost everywhere in the West or visited most of it. So it's a place that I thought deserved this sort of attention. And quite frankly, there's not a book out there like this. It seemed like a very logical topic to me to explore the beauty of the West, how it got there, and how we make sure that we keep it as we move forward into the future.
The concept of Eden you dispose of pretty early in the book, and give us an idea of how intensively the native population managed the land.
Well, I think you're absolutely on to the double entendre of my book, which is that we need to lose this mythic, pristine wilderness idea of Eden. It's just not helpful for understanding the deep history of this place that we call the West. And instead, if we think about the West as a place that has been inhabited, modified, and managed for thousands of years by Native people first, and obviously then a great plethora of different immigrants over time, then I think we have a much more realistic way of thinking about how humans and nature interact, how we can do so much more successfully than we have perhaps in the past.
There is another stereotype you do acknowledge, the West as colony, and that is backed by facts. Give us an idea of the movement of materials out of the West to other parts of the country and the world as settlers moved in.
Well, one of the things that was so attractive about the West to the rest of the country and the rest of the world was all of our natural resources, and they seemed in such abundance. Trees, fish, minerals, and that wealth was what was going to not only fatten the pockets of Eastern investors and make these gigantic corporations boom, but it's what would build the towns not only of the West, but fuel and oceanic trade across the Pacific. And ultimately, you know, I think it's safe to say that one doesn't really get to be a superpower as a country unless you've got a pretty significant natural resource base. And we were very fortunate to have kind of all of the key ingredients to make that possible, and most of them are in the West.
When you describe the gains to investors, though, it sounds almost like the original corporate welfare. The federal government did do a lot to make sure that the West did get developed.
It did, you know, and that was a lot in part because what the federal government needed to do when it acquired the West, it did so in these gigantic gulping land grabs. The 1803 Louisiana Purchase, single stroke of his pen, Jefferson more than doubled the size of the United States. Then we added in 1846 the Oregon Territory. In the 1848 Treaty of Guadalupe Hidalgo, we added the Mexican Cession. And then the last little piece, the Gadsden Purchase in 1853. So the acquisition of territory came really fast. And it's one of the great adages of sovereignty that the way to gain sovereignty is through settlement. And the way to encourage settlement is to offer stuff up nearly for free. So the federal government made land available very inexpensively with the Homestead Act. It encouraged cultivation on even marginal lands with things like the Timber and Stone Act, and also passed something called the Mining Law, the 1872 Mining Law, which again transferred public lands into private hands with the goal that if you could make a little money while you were at it, so much the better. You'd be even more motivated to move here.
And you write fairly succinctly in the first five pages about giving us a sense of the tension, people who can simultaneously love the wide open spaces and yet still want to exploit them.
Well, it's tempting to do so because in our market system, there is such incentive to make money, to gain wealth. And in the West, particularly early on, it seemed so easy. There was so much wealth available. It seemed like it was, in many ways, unlimited as a resource. And so I could take some, and that's really not going to destroy the whole of this beautiful place. And then I get to be rich and live here, and who doesn't want that?
And that takes us into your quoting here of Garrett Hardin's Tragedy of the Commons. Give us the cattle example, because this is a great way to understand it.
So Garrett Hardin was an ecologist, and he had this idea called the Tragedy of the Commons, where he said that he gives the example that in a community surrounded by a common grazing area, each individual could put a cow on the commons, and that would be sustainable. It's local and sustainable. But the problem comes when one of the individuals in the community thinks, okay, well, I could double my profit if I put two cows on the commons. And to be sure, if it's only that one person who puts an extra cow on the commons, that's not going to significantly degrade the commons, and there's no harm there. But the tragedy comes when everyone, acting in their own self-interest, makes that same choice, and they all put an extra cow on, and that becomes the tragedy. Then the commons itself is destroyed. And in the book, I try to use that idea to understand more public access resources like forests and water and minerals, because each person thinks they're going to make a profit.
Things that we all have to depend on together for a lot of reasons other than profit. Sarah Dant is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, historian at Weber State University. Her book is Losing Eden, An Environmental History of the American West. We'll come back and talk more with Sarah and take phone calls and emails from you when we return to the Exchange in 1 minute. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is Sarah Dant, history professor at Weber State University. She specializes in environmental politics and gives us a heavy dose of that in her new book called Losing Eden, An Environmental History of the American West, where she disputes the concept of us thinking about an Eden existing when white people arrived in the first place and maybe losing the whole concept of that along the way. You can join us on the Exchange. Much to talk about here, very relevant to our region. 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. And lest anybody think most of the book takes place in the 19th and 20th centuries, you take us way back to the Bering Land Bridge. Did it appear from what anthropologists know now that humans followed the animals across the bridge?
Exactly. I mean, these are prehistoric hunting and gathering people, and we're talking about a time period at least 15,000 years ago when the climate of the Earth was much cooler. We were in the middle of an ice age, and the Bering Strait, which is a waterway today, was actually a land bridge. And as animals migrated across that, the people who were hunting them did as well.
Interesting, though, because you point out that a lot of Native American origin stories seem to deny or at least eschew the migration story.
Right. A lot of Native Americans their stories about origin are rooted in the place that they're from, whether it's, you know, the Black Hills or the deserts of the West. And so it would be logical for them to find then their origin in the place where they have lived and what they have known.
Now, in terms of the resources, and this is where things get really interesting in the book, is thinking that it wasn't just white people moving across the continent in the 19th century that hunted some animals nearly to extinction, but the fact is that there were megafauna in North America thousands of years ago that ended up going extinct. And I've heard the theories that humans hunted them to extinction, but is there another version as well?
Well, I think like all historical events, it's much more complicated than we've often anticipated. It's nice when there are simple explanations, but simple is not often accurate. And so when we look at the Pleistocene extinctions, which occurred about 10,000 years ago, this is when we lost a lot of those gigantic animals like saber-toothed tigers and mastodons and things like that. We can certainly see that there's evidence in some cases of human hunting. Something like mastodons, for example, they just have an incredibly long gestational period. They have very few young, and so their ability to reproduce quickly when they're engaged in hunting pressure isn't there. They didn't evolve being hunted by humans, and so that sort of brought them to a pretty quick end. But then there are other mysteries like the loss of the horse, which we just really don't have a good explanation for what happened. There's not a lot of evidence of human hunting of horses early, and yet that's one of the animals that goes extinct in the Pleistocene era. And so probably that has to do as much with climate fluctuation as anything else, and probably a convergence of all of those things is the best explanation. Human predation plus climate change plus all sorts of things.
So there were indigenous horses in North America, as has been pointed out many times, but they died out, and the ones that are here now actually came from European stock brought in by explorers and settlers.
That's exactly right. Yeah, the Spanish bring them back, and because in some ways they were already pre-adapted to North America, once they get loose on this continent again, they've flourished.
I want to make sure we differentiate here. When you mentioned the term climate change, we're really talking about climate change as in ice ages beginning and ending and that sort of thing.
Right? Sure. I mean, so climate change is you can understand that as a very basic idea, as a change in climate. And so when we talk about climate change, often what we're looking at is fluctuations in temperature. But in the past, that has been long-term, a degree or two that happens over tens of thousands of years. And what distinguishes that from what we're seeing today is the rate of change.
Okay, we're talking to Sarah Dant, the author of Losing Eden, An Environmental History of the American West. I want to get into then, as people settled the North American continent, how sophisticated was the agriculture of natives in parts of the West?
I think it's pretty remarkable, actually, because as climate changed, as we moved away from that ice age 15,000 years ago and temperatures gradually warmed over the next 10 to 15,000 years, then people had to adapt in order to survive. And in places like the American Southwest, that meant suddenly going from, or not suddenly, but that meant going from what had been a more lush green environment to something that was pretty brown and arid. And the only way to make that work is to utilize irrigation. And we see some very sophisticated irrigation in places, say, around what is present-day Phoenix. In fact, so sophisticated that some of the current irrigation strategies for that particular place around Phoenix are just overlaid on the Hohokam that had come before.
How far back in time did the Hohokam use these?
So agriculture in North America comes about 3,000 to 4,000 years ago. It moved up out of Mexico with the advent of corn and the evolution of corn as a crop. So we're talking, 2,000 to 3,000 years of experience in this place using that particular technique, and obviously getting better the longer you're doing it.
I'm struck by the parallels between the people of 3,000, 4,000 years ago and today when you do write extensively about how corn became such a staple in the Native American diet. And, of course, we talk about how prevalent corn is today and with the overlaying concern of genetically modified corn. But how big a part of the diet, and what were some of the pitfalls in depending so heavily upon corn?
Well, it depended, of course, on where you were as to whether or not you were consuming corn. I mean, people in Oregon and Washington, for example, are not growing corn. So mostly where you see it is in the more arid Southwest. And it has its advantages, of course, because it's a very sugar, energy-intensive crop. But it also has real disadvantages. One is that it's very nutrient-depleting of the soil. And that's one of the reasons that you often see it planted with beans and squash, those three plants together, sometimes called the three sisters, because they form a nice, sustainable, more sustainable, at least, agricultural trio. But something as simple as grinding corn with a stone metate means that little pieces of stone are going to get in your ground corn. And then as you eat that, it wears out your teeth. And so there are some very interesting studies about people who are very reliant on corn are actually less healthy because, for one thing, they don't have a lot of teeth, and because that reliance on a crop, a single crop, makes them vulnerable to other problems.
Interesting. So in a lot of the arguments about resource use in the West, particularly where it comes to timber, we talk about monoculture and single species plantations, and it's no better for humans than it is for hillsides, it sounds like.
No, not at all. I mean, the whole idea of evolution, and if you want, we can talk about how this affects bees, because I know bees are a major part of the crops in both Oregon and California. But any species needs a diversity of inputs, because we can't even really understand completely what all it is that we derive from the things that we consume. But a diversity of diet, just like a diversity in a forest, is ultimately a much healthier and more sustainable lifeway.
I'll take you up on that riff on bees, because it's certainly a lot of interest in both Oregon and California, where we serve, about bees. And is it about the monoculture farms and how that affects the populations of the pollinators?
That too. I mean, I've been a hobby beekeeper for a number of years, so bees are kind of near and dear to my heart. And one of the interesting things that has come about for bees in general is, since 2006, a phenomenon called colony collapse disorder. And that's a phenomenon where you have normally healthy hives. Everything that should be there is there, queen, brood, honey, everything, and then it just disappears. The hive just disappears. And we're talking about some catastrophic losses in some cases for beekeepers across the country. It's on the order of sometimes 60, even 90% of bees. And on the average, we're losing about a third of the bee colonies, honeybee colonies, a year to this mysterious malady. And one of the interesting things that they've studied at Washington State University is the idea that, especially in the almond groves, those bees are exposed to one and only one pollination source, and as a result, they're not getting a diversity of inputs from the environment around them. Perhaps that's one of the things that's making them more vulnerable.
The environment and people and how they interrelate is the overall topic of Sarah Dant's book, Losing Eden, An Environmental History of the American West. This is a conversation you are welcome to join on the Jefferson Exchange. Lots to talk about here, obviously. 800-838-3760 on your phone, on your computer or mobile device. It's jx@jeffnet.org. Let's go to George in Wairika. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Wow, what a fascinating and timely, maybe too late type thing. Thank you for the book. I'm looking forward to buying it. However, I did purchase one, and it was called Collapse, and it had to do with Easter Island, the Anasazi, the Norse in Greenland, collapsed civilizations whose habits and eating pretty well ate them out of house and home, literally to the point where they disappeared. What are we going to do about the Oglala Reservoir and the uncontrolled taking of that water?
All right, great question. Thanks for that, George.
Hi, George. Thank you. I think that you bringing up Jared Diamond's book, Collapse, is a really relevant topic here, because, of course, what he talks about in that book, and as you've just very nicely described, is that when environments, when people overreach the carrying capacity of their environment, they then pay the ultimate price with, as his title says, collapse. And you point out a really vulnerable portion of our country, that is the tremendous farmlands that are irrigated by the Oglala Aquifer. And I do talk about that some in the book, because that's, of course, the very part of the country that was so negatively affected during the Dust Bowl. And as I write in the book, I mean, one of the things that was so unfortunate is that with the invention of the V8 engine and the ability to tut, tut, tut the Oglala Aquifer over those parched lands of the plains, we weren't humbled by the Dust Bowl. We were sort of challenged by it. And I think that your concern is a very valid one, because we often see that technology is going to be the answer, that we'll just engineer our way out of a problem. And as in Oregon and California, the use of Oglala groundwater is not long-term sustainable. That's not a resource that renews at the rate that we're taking it out. And so we're going to have to begin to think about being smarter with irrigation and where we grow crops. Is this really the best place or the best crop to be growing in this spot?
Which is a challenge of society now, but that you use the term carrying capacity for what the land can logically sustain. And you point out, though, that even pre-colonization, that Native Americans reached the carrying capacity themselves of their environments. Give us some examples.
So when we look, again, the arid Southwest is kind of the easiest spot to look at that. But when we look at the people around the Four Corners area, many people are probably familiar with Mesa Verde. You can tell that this is a very successful settlement because these people have the luxury of time and effort to build cliff dwellings. That's not something you do if you're teetering on the brink of starvation. And yet, in the end, they exceeded the carrying capacity in part because they weren't compensating for drought years. And we have to begin to, in the West, consider what the influence of drought is. And as we enter a period of global climate change and intensified drought, that is going to be something that we must pay attention to.
All right, some other practices that that the Native Americans did before white people arrived. I'm really fascinated by the handling of large slaughters of buffalo, because it actually reminded me a little bit of the concentrated animal feeding operations that get criticized today, just in terms of the mass scale of obtaining of animals. So how did Native Americans kill a bunch of buffalo at once?
So probably the most famous example of that was what were called buffalo jumps, and it was this very well-coordinated group effort to drive a herd over a cliff and obviously to their death. And then the women would come in and process those bison, and there would be food that could be dried or obviously consumed at that moment, but not all of that. Is there some waste when that happens? Yeah, absolutely. But the idea was then that you could create enough food to last you throughout much of the season.
Sarah Dant is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. Her book is Losing Eden, An Environmental History of the American West. So now along comes Columbus and a lot of people behind him. The Columbian Exchange, I hadn't heard that term before. What does that mean?
So the Columbian Exchange is a really terrific idea from environmental history that Alfred Crosby developed, where when the Europeans finally show up with Columbus, and he's not the first European, but the significance of him is that the connection he makes between Europe and Asia and the Americas lasts, because once the Ice Age ended, then the Americas existed basically in isolation from the rest of the world. That meant that their plants and animals evolved uniquely in this place. And once Columbus then reestablishes connection and makes the Atlantic Ocean from a barrier into a bridge, it allows people, plants, animals, and disease to move back and forth across that Atlantic Ocean, but ultimately then circulate around the world. And that was profoundly transformative for everyone.
The speed of changes boggles the mind, but the pathways too. For example, when you talk about how dandelions got here, I never heard this before.
Well, yeah, and it's not that the Europeans come off of their ships, of course, and start blowing dandelion seeds everywhere because they're giddy or something. But they do bring with them horses and cows and sheep and goats, pigs. These are all old world European imports into the New World. We didn't have any of those prior to the arrival of Europeans. And the feed that comes with those domesticated animals has seeds from the plants that they eat back in Europe. And once those are unleashed in North America, they take over. And there's been a lot of discussion about, and Diamond talks about this too, Jared Diamond talks about this in his Guns, Germs, and Steel book, where it's one of the reasons that the Europeans are so successful is because their plants and their animals succeed so well.
We are talking to Sarah Dant, who is a history professor at Weber State University in Utah, about her book, Losing Eden, An Environmental History of the American West. We'll come back and talk more with Sarah and invite you to join that conversation on the Jefferson Exchange. I've got a couple of calls waiting at the moment. Also want to remind you as we head to this break that this is the final day of Fall Fund Drive here at Jefferson Public Radio. And let me call the numbers up for you because we are seeking $170,000 in pledges by the time all is said and done. We are just short of $121,000 at this point, so still have about $49,000 in change to raise over the course of the next 10 hours or so. Can we do it? Absolutely. We have in the past, but we need to put the pedal to the metal. 888-552-6191 to make a pledge of support by phone. Make that pledge online at ijpr.org, and we'll come back and talk more with Sarah Dant in 1 minute and 5 seconds. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest is Sarah Dant, a historian at Weber State University in Utah. She specializes in environmental politics and serves up a healthy dose of that in her book, Losing Eden, An Environmental History of the American West, disabusing us of the notion that the white people who moved west across the continent found a pristine wilderness untouched by human hands. There obviously were millions of human beings living on the North American continent long before anybody from Europe showed up, and they were making use of the resources. It also gives us a sense of how people can at one time praise the beauty of the West and how much they like living in it and yet want to use all the resources that it provides as well. You're welcome to join the conversation at 800-838-3760 by phone or by email jx@jeffnet.org. So we're just talking about the Columbian Exchange and all the things that happened after people began crossing the Atlantic to North America, bringing disease and animals and plants and all sorts of new stuff. You do give us a contrast, though, between the subsistence societies that were here and the commercial economies that began to establish. What is Liebig's Law?
So Liebig's Law is a law that talks about how populations are limited by the scarcest amount available at the leanest time. It's a way to naturally stay within the carrying capacity of the land itself. And so when you are living locally, when your food supply is derived from the local environment, then you cannot really exceed the carrying capacity of the land, because if you do, then unfortunately some people are going to die off when things get tight. And it, by staying local, then we have much more sustainable kinds of populations and interactions with the land.
So when the people are eating the things that happen locally, plants or animals, and taking care of those, so they tend to sort of reinforce each other. But then when you get into the situation of shipping fur hats to Paris, for example, that begins to warp the system just a bit. And in fact, there's a great quote in here from the fur trapper Richens Wooten. He said, "The Wild West is no longer wild." And I was surprised at how early that statement was.
Well, you know, again, so many of them are seeing changes in the land very quickly, very early. As soon as people start settling and engaging in a market economy, the entire interaction with the land is going to change. And somebody like Wooten's, who is involved in the fur trade and facilitating westward expansion by Euro-Americans, is going to see those changes pretty keenly, I think.
Let's take a couple of calls here. I have Moisha and Eugene on the line. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Sarah Dant, the author of Losing Eden.
Thank you so much. How are you?
I'm doing well. Yourself?
Great. Your host is wonderful. Thank you, Jeff, and your guest is too. This is Moshe Immerman and Eugene. I'm a professional research ecologist and biologist, and as you know, teach and practice Oriental medicine. I've also lived with Yosemite Miwok, Havasu Indians, Hopis, and others. Their relationship with the land and the oceans tends to be sacred, where the inner consciousness of people is related through their life and their dreams with what's happening with what we call our resource base, but really it's the living spirit out there. What gets the short shrift in the extractive economies we're in now is the intergenerational and interspecies effects of what we do. We lose out on that. Brief examples. Atrazine is used on corn and is causing massive birth defects in us and in frogs, and it's legal here but not in Europe. Another example, marijuana. It reduces our immune strength, causes people to, by and large, not remember their dreams, and it reduces male fertility. What happens over generations when we do this? Interspecies-wise, briefly, Fukushima. Who asked us to give radiation to nearly 92 species of whales and dolphins, and what happens to their genetics over thousands of years with all these nuclear reactors along the oceans in the Pacific? Please take a deeper look at intergenerational and interspecies effects and how we can really begin to understand, feel that, and do something about it. All thank right. you, my friend.
Moshe, thanks for that. Appreciate it. Sarah, thoughts?
Well, I think that one of the reasons that I wrote this book was because I firmly believe that people care about what they know, and Moesha was addressing exactly that. And I think that, you know, for a lot of people, history is this thing that happened in the past, and it's irrelevant presidents that they can't really remember from that test they had to take a long time ago. And history is never just a thing of the past. It's an active factor in our lives. And how well we understand what has gone before us helps us to figure out the best way to move forward into the future. And if we know about the world around us, if we know about how it is that human interactions with people and plants and animals and the land itself have evolved over time, I think that makes us much wiser stewards as we move toward the future.
Another call here from Gail and Eugene. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Hello.
Hi.
I wonder if your guest is familiar with the work of an MIT researcher, Dr. Stephanie Seneff, who has postulated that the collapse disorder, the colony collapse disorder, wasn't a function of pesticides such as Roundup and neonics killing off the helpful bacteria in bees' guts so that they starve to death, essentially.
Okay, I hadn't heard that one before. Thanks for that, Gail. Appreciate it. Sarah, any recollection there?
No, that's not a specific study that I'm familiar with, but I think that one of the general conclusions that's coming from a lot of these different bee studies is that it's probably not just one factor, but like so many other things in nature, it's a perfect storm of problems that's visiting on our bees. And these pesticides like the neonicotinoids that you're talking about and the pollination issues of only single species pollination, all of these are potentially what weaken bees and then allow something else to come in, whether it's a parasitic mite, whether it's gut bacteria. It can be something else that normally wouldn't have gotten the bees, but because they're weakened and made more vulnerable by these environmental inputs, that's what can cause them to ultimately experience this colony collapse disorder.
It's interesting to look at the current concerns in the context of what you look at historically in this book, Losing Eden. For example, thinking that grizzly bears disappeared from California by hunting, it may actually have been a contributing factor that all that hydraulic mining was going on, washing away hillsides and clogging up streams with silt. Salmon were disappearing and bears ate salmon. And this didn't go unnoticed. As you point out, John Wesley Powell made some observations about the West as early as 1878. What was he saying?
Well, Powell was arguing that we can't look at the West the way we have looked at the East. It's just not the same. The Green East is different, and the way we have to live in the Green East is very different than how we have to live in the brown, more arid West. And so what Powell advocated as early as 1878 was what he called watershed commonwealth. We need to settle where there's water. And there is water in the West, and what a lot of people may not realize was that Powell was an advocate of dams and irrigation. But he said, you can't settle everywhere in the West. We need to instead be much more thoughtful and put the people where there's water, not put water where the people are. And as you can tell, we pretty much largely ignored him.
I'm also, you include the information here about the Census Bureau declaring the American frontier officially closed in 1890. Based on what?
So the census has a somewhat arbitrary designation for what the frontier is. And their definition is two or fewer people per square mile. That constitutes a frontier. And by 1890, the census at least showed that from sea to shining sea, we had exceeded that kind of population in our settlement patterns. But that's not terribly helpful because in many ways the frontier reappeared in the 20th century in places like the Great Plains as people vacated some of those formerly settled territories. So that idea of the frontier was one that caused people to have a bit of a reckoning with what does this all mean, where do we go now, but it also is a little bit of a frustration because there's this very Eurocentric white bias to it, and some at least in history have even referred to it as the F word.
Sarah Dant has been our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, a history professor at Weber State University and the author of the truly eye-opening book called Losing Eden, An Environmental History of the American West. Sarah, pleasure to talk to you. Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you so much. My pleasure as well.
All right, take care.